Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry here with a live audience where I've been feeling the wind sweeping off the plains all week here in Oklahoma, broadcasting from KOSU in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Make some noise, folks. Does that wind ever stop? No, it never stops. Well, people here are more likely to be tuned to the Weather Channel for that reason, perhaps, than cable news, listening to every little development in Washington, D.C. And on our last day here in the Heartland, we will hear in just a moment from someone who does retail politics better than almost anyone. We will experience the enthusiastic, can-do approach to local politics of Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett. But first, it's can-do or will-do. The Trump administration continues to accelerate its executive orders, announcements, and challenges to the Washington bureaucracy. The president intends to build his wall on the border. He intends to reduce the quota of refugees the U.S. will accept and to ban people from so-called terror-prone nations of the Middle East. Does that constitute a Muslim ban? We'll have to find out. Joining us to talk about what the president can actually do amidst this flurry of announcements, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Can-do attitude, is that enough?
Yeah, and the executive orders, John, as you said, are pouring out of this White House for the third straight day. President Trump today going with immigration and national security. And one order that's going to be music to the ears of immigration hardliners in the Republican Party, many of whom, by the way, are upset with the president right now and his first few days in office. And I'll tell you why. The president has an executive order authorizing and ordering construction of that wall, John, the one that we heard so much about in the campaign and in the transition period. The president signing an executive order ordering that wall to go forward. Now, he can't do this alone. He will need Congress. The president simply does not have the power to appropriate the money, the billions that will be required for the construction of this wall. However, Donald Trump will satisfy, to an extent, some of the immigration hardliners in Congress and outside of Congress who are really upset right now. Why? Because of DACA, the Deferred Action Program, the one that lets children of undocumented immigrants stay in the United States and apply for visas and be protected from deportation. Donald Trump pledged to end that program immediately when he was campaigning and when he was in the transition period of his presidency. He hasn't done it yet, and the DACA program is still accepting applications today. A lot of the hardliners, John, are very upset about that, and you can imagine why. Donald Trump tomorrow on Thursday will be in Philadelphia at the retreat of congressional Republicans to talk to them. So this border wall announcement will satisfy them to an extent, but certainly not all the way.
It seems as though the president is using these executive order photo ops as a way of almost confusing the extent to which legislation is his responsibility or Congress's responsibility. Where is the policy going to come from? It gets him a little bit off the hook if he has these, you know, high profile executive order photo ops.
John, on the border wall, that is certainly true. It's also true on things like the Obamacare executive order the other day, which was largely symbolic. But on immigration orders from predominantly Muslim countries and the refugee program, the president has broad powers here. So these orders are real. The president is going to stop immigration from six predominantly Muslim countries, and you can guess which ones they are: Syria, Libya, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, completely suspending any visas from those countries temporarily, while ordering the United States to study a stricter vetting policy for any immigrants coming from those countries. At the same time, almost completely suspending the refugee program, including from Syria, victims of war and oppression in other countries who come to this country. That program is suspended almost completely, except, as we understand it, for some religious minorities. Who that includes, we don't know. But refugees from Syria and many other countries, that program completely suspended. And the president does have the power to do it.
Does this become then the making good on the promise of a Muslim ban? Will the president say, no, it's not a Muslim ban, it's something different than that? Will Democrats focus on the ban and the religious elements that might make it seem like a Muslim ban?
I think you can certainly expect that, and the early reaction to the expectations of these announcements have fallen along those lines. Now, there's other aspects, John, to a proposed Muslim ban that really raises the question of how are people tracked within this country, whether they're immigrants or even U.S. citizens. People have talked about databases. There were databases that were suspended by President Obama that did track Muslim immigrants into this country. That program is gone. Donald Trump and some of his supporters have suggested restarting it. We don't know where that stands.
Hans Willick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
A swish of a pen at the White House and President Trump makes it look easy. Poof. The pipelines are back.
This is with regard to the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, something that's been in dispute, and it's subject to a renegotiation of terms by us.
The simple strokes of a pen set in motion many uncertainties, funding, construction deadlines. And chief among the uncertainties is the reaction of Native Americans, whose victory last year at Standing Rock in North Dakota is now in question with a suddenly reopened door for the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline from North and South Dakota to Illinois, as well as the Keystone XL Pipeline. Joining us from North Dakota now, Tara Hauska, National Campaign Director for Honor the Earth. She's a tribal attorney. Tara, what's your reaction? Where do things go from here, do you think?
I really was not very surprised to see Donald Trump take such a move. He's made his environmental policies quite clear when he put a CEO of Exxon in charge of the Secretary of State position. Where it goes from here is continuing what we have already been doing, grassroots organizing and getting the attention of millions, literally millions of people around the world that now know about the Dakota Access fight and are, in this local governance system in the United States. We're looking at, are we really willing to accept the fact that, we see a government putting corporate interests ahead of the interests of the American people in clean drinking water? There are 17 million people that live along the Missouri. So we continue to organize. That's how we got our victory last year, and that's how we'll continue to win.
The principal issue, it seemed, in Standing Rock last year before the Obama administration shut things down was consultation with the tribe over the potential desecration of sacred lands. It seemed as though an accommodation was reached. Do we expect that the Trump administration would continue with that accommodation, or are they setting up a situation which says tribes be damned?
I think, the issue of tribal consultation is one that became prominent because it was so obvious in this situation that the tribes' rights were being completely run over, knowing that the pipeline was rerouted from Bismarck, a largely white community, due to the concerns of their drinking water, and instead put half a mile north of the reservation because somehow the tribes' drinking water didn't matter. That's, a major concern. However, that's just one piece. Destruction of sacred sites is certainly something. Going through unceded treaty territories is certainly something. But I think the tribe is really looking for, and we're really looking for this overall understanding of, if you're going to do a project of this size, do a full environmental review. If you're going to try to slam a 1,200-mile pipeline, nearly 1,200 miles, we at a minimum deserve a full environmental impact statement. And that's what we got with the Obama administration. The executive order that Trump put forward is actually really not that clear. It's kind of vague on exactly what's going to happen. And so I think the process is going to continue. Obviously, there's an environmental impact statement that's being done right now. You have to follow the Administrative Procedures Act. There are certain guarantees by the federal law, the protections that remain in place regardless of Donald Trump's assertion that he will dismantle the EPA. At the same time, there's also this grassroots effort of people that are divesting from the banks that actually are supporting the Dakota Access project. And that's actually caused major investors to reassess their interest in this project. That's real change. The bottom line is always what really matters, right?
Is there a tribal interest, assuming that collaboration could be achieved, in actually building these pipelines and jobs for everybody and prosperity in North Dakota and other places along the Missouri, or is that just off the table?
I think the concept of, you know, the tribes benefiting from all these jobs, right? They always talk about the creation of jobs. These are temporary construction jobs, and most of this pipeline has already been constructed. The benefit to North Dakota is very, very minimal at this point. You know, instead, these local communities, as in any pipeline project, are the ones that bear the risk. They bear the risk of the leaks that happen. So I think, you know, the focus really should be on why is our federal government, why are our, you know, elected officials allowing this focus on fossil fuel infrastructure that is actually really, really risky, you know, as a project. You know, you look at the benefit and the risk. Why would we look at that when we can be instead moving towards green energy, creation of, you know, jobs that way, generation of energy that way, true energy independence through renewable energy that does not put our finite resources at risk.
Tara, finally, Donald Trump has a lot of experience in his gaming businesses in dealing with tribes on the East Coast and in other places where there is casino gambling. And he's known to be very competitive and in some cases ruthless with the tribal business interests. What's the feeling about Trump in his ability to deal with the tribes in something as delicate as this?
Donald Trump, when he was opposed to what was happening, you know, the competition that he had with the casinos on the East Coast, he sat in front of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs next to the Mashantucket Pequot people and said that the Mashantucket Pequots weren't real Indians because they didn't look like Indians to other Indians and they didn't look like Indians to him. That is, you know, a perfect example of his interpretation of Native people. What they are supposed to be, what we are supposed to be, and, you know, this complete lack of regard for tribal sovereign nations that exist within the United States. I think that we're going to have to rely very heavily on our own sovereignty, on looking to ourselves to make sure that our rights are upheld, and trying to look towards our Congress on both sides of the aisle, which have a, you know, a duty to the First Peoples of this nation. And, you know, the upholding of the trust responsibility, it's not just one man. It is the entire system that is supposed to acknowledge the treaties that were signed.
Tara Houska is National Campaign Director for Honor the Earth, a tribal attorney. Thanks so much, Tara.
Thank you.
President Trump wants to build both the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access pipelines. Do you agree with that decision?
My name is Leela, and no, I don't support either of these messages. And why? Because I'm taking the long view. I'm choosing the future health of the planet and water to support life over short-term profits to a short-sighted few who don't and won't share their gains.
Little Rock, Arkansas, yes, we need to be as energy independent and competitive as possible.
This is Bruce Bennett from Plano, Texas. I back the union position that the Keystone Pipeline will create numerous new jobs.
Tomorrow, you'll hear how these pipeline disputes are resurrecting a deep sense of Native American pride and solidarity across North America. Elfrida Dunkin is a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. Her powerful message you'll hear tomorrow is, we are here.
It's just kind of a, almost like a dichotomy to me. You put us there, and then you want what we have, and you want us to be an independent, sovereign people and work for ourselves, but yet you keep taking and taking.
I'll be talking with Elfrida Dunkin tomorrow, but what's your reaction to what she has to say? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now, here with me is Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett. Born and raised here in Oklahoma City, he's the first mayor in this city's history to be elected to a fourth term. He helped get the city an NBA franchise. He's the reason the Thunder is here. He put the entire city on a diet, and I'm trying to see. It seems to have worked with you folks out there.
We all look like supermodels now.
That's right. He's invested in infrastructure and public education to improve the quality of life and civic engagement, a robust population growth here in Oklahoma City, low cost of living, diversified economy. Mayor Cornett, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello there. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here. You know, until I came to Oklahoma City as a journalist, I'd only come to this town for disasters. The Murrah Building disaster in 1995, tornadoes of one kind or another. It's great to be here to just see how the city responds to day-to-day life and fits into the heartland.
Well, and you bring up a good point, because our city had been branded by tragedy, or maybe I should say we'd had allowed ourselves to be branded by tragedy. And I think that's one of the benefits of having the NBA basketball team, which you mentioned, is now when you think of Oklahoma City, there's an opportunity to think of something positive. Certainly, we're proud of the way we reacted to those tragic events that you talked about, but Oklahoma City is much more of that. And now we're succeeding in attracting highly educated 20-somethings, have one of the top economies in the country, and we finish at or near the top in most quality of life barometers.
How do you get people to move on and join hands to get something done, regardless of partisan affiliation? I mean, this is a very conservative state, but the kinds of things that you've done here in Oklahoma City don't smack of conservative ideology.
That's right. I think people here have separated the type of government they like from the type of government they don't like. What we've had most of our success in is asking people to help us pay for a lot of infrastructure projects, sports arenas, canals in our entertainment district, new libraries, new schools. And people here like the idea of paying for it with a sales tax for a certain number of years. We pay cash. We don't go into debt when we use that funding philosophy. And they know that tax is going to end at the end, or they'll at least have a chance to review it with another list of projects that they can consider at the time. But they seem to have differentiated between that type of paying for government as opposed to the type that states and the federal government apply, which are typically for social programs. Typically, they don't get to vote on them, and typically they don't ever seem to end.
This is a state capital, mm-hmm. So you've got the state government right down the road. There appears to be a certain amount of gridlock in the approval of services for education statewide. Have you worked around that here in Oklahoma City to get funding for kids in this city?
Well, a few years back, we passed an initiative to rebuild all of the schools in the inner city district. So we built a new or refurbished all 75 buildings. So we have a whole brand new, round of infrastructure, new buses, new technology, and all those things. The level of education is inconsistent throughout the city. We have 24 school districts, if you can imagine, that serve kids that live inside the city limits. Some of them are offering some of the highest level of education in the country, and some of them are really struggling. So there's a lot of social issues that affect the family for those kids are coming from. That's a bigger, test than it is the education system. But also, I think more and more it's a mistake to define a community's education commitment just by K-12. You got to look at pre-K. You got to look at the career tech system. You got to look at higher ed. And I would even add that in today's advancing technology, that adults are going to have to continue to educate themselves well beyond their 20s. And so a community's commitment to education is going to have to be determined by a lot of other factors now instead of just the K-12 in the inner city district.
So it's not just a diet, you guys. It's homework. There's homework,
that's
it sounds
right.
Like, with the mayor.
We go to school.
Just 2 minutes, but I wanted to bring up something maybe a little more philosophical. The president, on his farewell address, Barack Obama, said, you got to get out of your bubbles to understand what's going on in America and not just listen to the kinds of things you agree with. Donald Trump is a very different sort of no more business as usual kind of president. We've come here with the idea of getting out of the bubbles. What's your advice on, what message and what this community has to offer versus what you constantly hear in the media?
Well, one similarity between, I think, the Trump philosophy and Oklahoma's philosophy is that we have taken a lot of steps to be pro-business to try and create jobs. And we have a lot of our social services are met through philanthropy, faith-based organizations, nonprofits. If you have a really strong economy, you can create enough wealth in your community where those nonprofits can help you on the social issue side. And I think the Trump administration is going to judge these 4 years by how many jobs are created and how strong the economy is. I think that's the barometer for most all of their policy decisions.
Should there be a safety net? Should government be a part of healing racial divides in a city like Oklahoma?
Well, absolutely. And, one of the issues there is if we're going to have more community policing, if we're going to have more de-escalation policies, those are wonderful programs, but they take more men power and women power in our force. We may need some help in trying to figure out how we're going to pay these additional police officers and firefighters. So we agree with the philosophy of it, but right now, most cities in America are struggling to keep up with the cost of public safety as it is. Keep in mind, in the United States, the first responders in cities are protecting this nation. We don't have a federal police force that's out in every city like much of the developed world. And so if we are going to be the first responders to protect our nation from terrorism and other acts of that might come from another federal government, the city should be reimbursed for those services.
A fifth term?
We'll see.
We'll see.
I got another year in this.
We'll see. Make some noise, folks. Mayor Cornett, Mick Cornett, Mayor of Oklahoma City and President of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Thank you so much,
you
Mayor.
Thanks again.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Oklahoma, a portrait of political gridlock and how it affects kids in school. We begin with the ugly math in the Oklahoma budget. A $900 million shortfall that has to be balanced. But this state is experiencing a crisis in its prison overcrowding and a prolonged stagnation in education spending. There's talk on the edge to tweak tax exemptions here and raise fees there. But after years of nonstop Republican majorities celebrating lower taxes, lawmakers are hearing that they may have gone too far. Representative Leslie Osborne is among the most powerful lawmakers in the state. The chair of the Appropriations and Budget Committee may be in a bind, though. She's hearing two messages at once: keep taxes low and raise spending for teachers, mental health, and other services. But can she get the legislature to figure this one out?
What I was hearing at the doorstop and at different speeches and gatherings over the last 8 years has really changed into now. I do believe people realize that we have made these cuts and that we are not providing the level of services that they do expect as citizens. And honestly, for the first time, I feel that it is possible that we will be able to broaden the tax base. And by saying that, I mean, would we potentially look at taxing services? All of our contiguous states do that. Would we consider a sliding gas tax or diesel tax scale? Do we look at something like our very low gross production rate of 2%? So I think there's a lot of things on the table this year.
Some of this began at the federal level under Obama, but do you see a sea change and a revolution in corrections policy and, you know, how communities are going to be able to deal with that? Building more prisons is not viable anymore.
Absolutely. And that's been a huge initiative here the last several years. Last year, we passed several measures in the House and Senate that were signed by the governor, like the justice safety valve, which actually gives discretion to judges that are sent things with mandatory sentences to actually say, you know, I'm not sure this really merits this mandatory. We are overcrowded in our prisons, and I actually have a rolling bond issue for DOC, but that is not necessarily that I think that we need more prisons to lock more people up. It's that the prisons that we do have are substandard and crumbling infrastructure. So we may need to actually change the way some of our prisons are done to have more that have a mental health emphasis, to have more that have areas where we could actually get more programming with a GED attainment, with actual training for jobs. We are looking at our licensing. Should all of our licenses in Oklahoma require that you've never been a felon?
You're talking about counseling. You're talking about social rehabilitation. You're talking about community outreach. I mean, you're talking like someone from Ann Arbor, Michigan, in some Democratic, social services agency.
Okay, but isn't that refreshing? Wouldn't it be nice if every once in a while we could all work together and try to do the right thing? And I really feel like in Oklahoma there's been a sea change. You know, we have new leadership running the Senate and the House this year. The governor is a lame duck. She's in her last 2 years, so things are going to be a little easier for her to push through that she might not have felt comfortable pushing through before. That's how politics work. I really do see that sea change for justice reinvestment, for spending our dollars in a different manner, and for actually broadening the base where we can provide more services than we have been. And I feel like that should be a bipartisan issue. I don't think that should be a red or blue state issue. I think it should be about what's best for your state.
Some people from the outside, and we are from the outside, would ask the question, do you have to get to four-day school weeks and 49th rankings in teacher salaries to consider education an emergency? Is that necessary?
When you look at our low cost of living, we are more like 35th in the nation in teacher pay. Now, does that make it acceptable? Still, no. We're not prioritizing enough to teacher pay. I expect the bill that would do a three-year stepped-in $6,000 per teacher pay raise to pass this year. But that being said, did we have to get to this point where all of a sudden people feel like, though, we've reached a crisis point. I think it did. I think it did take that for us to seriously consider looking at broadening the tech base.
Republican Representative Leslie Osborne is chair of the Appropriations and Budget Committee in the state of Oklahoma. A federal law passed in the 1970s requires that public schools provide adequate education to children with special needs. The problem, however, is that the bar for what adequate education is varies with each community, each family, each disability, and each school district. Today, the Supreme Court hears arguments in Andrew v. Douglas County School District that involves a Colorado couple who withdrew their autistic son from public school, saying from their perspective, the bar for adequate was far too low. Can the Supreme Court clarify this requirement for the estimated 5.7% of school-aged children who have been identified as having specific learning disabilities? Wayne Steedman is a senior partner with the Steedman Law Group and works on special education law. He says the last time the Supreme Court considered the appropriate level of educational benefit for children with disabilities was 1982 in a case known as Rowley.
The reason it's coming back to the court today is that the law has been amended multiple times since the Rowley case in 1982. And each time Congress has amended the law, they have increased more of a burden, if you will, on the school system, raising the bar higher in terms of what is required for a child to be receiving an appropriate education. But at no time did Congress ever say, well, we're overruling Rowley and establishing a new standard. And when Congress does that, when they make it that clear, then it's easy for the courts. But since they never did that, then the courts are still struggling with what does this sum educational benefit actually mean. Throughout the country, various courts look at it and say, well, you know, this is what we think it means, and they don't all think it means the same thing.
To be clear, there's no constitutional issue here. It's just the lack of clarity in the law that governs special education for people with disabilities.
That would be correct, yes.
Now, would the court, under any circumstances, come up with a standard? I mean, disabled children are so varied and their needs are so completely diverse. I'm at a loss to imagine any kind of standard that would work here.
Yeah, it's not going to be specific. They're not going to say that, well, each and every child has to achieve at X level. It's going to have to be something along the lines of perhaps saying that children with disabilities must meet certain requirements of the Act. And the Act does spell out a number of requirements, such as narrowing the gap between children with disabilities and children without disabilities, ensuring that children move towards developing skills that will allow them to be independent, employment, as well as further future education. So those are the stated purposes of the Act. You know, when you look at it that way, you have to say that trivial, minimal benefit certainly is going to accomplish that.
In the tone of the Act, in the kind of reason the Act exists, do the schools play a role of enthusiastically wanting to incorporate special education into their curriculum, or is this a burden that they view as something that they'll do the minimum of, and it has nothing to do with their primary mission?
Well, I think that that's going to vary from school district to school district, and we've got a lot of school districts in the country. And I've certainly encountered school districts that are enthusiastically embracing the idea of helping a child with a significant disability make progress and try and help that child develop the skills that they need to move on for independence and employment or further education. And then you have some school districts who do see it as a burden and see it as an expense, an unfunded mandate, if you will, although there is funding for the IDEA by the federal government. But the funding has never been at the level that Congress promised when they first enacted the law in 1975. So, it's going to vary from school district to school district. Some are going to say, yeah, it's a burden, and others are going to say that this child has the right to an appropriate education to the same extent as any other child, and we're going to do our best for every single child.
Wayne Steedman is senior partner with the Steedman Law Group. He has 2 decades of experience representing children and parents with disabilities in the special education system. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you, John. It was my pleasure.
And we are in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, with an audience of thousands here, very loyal listeners to KOSU in Oklahoma City. And we're going to continue talking about education in this state and in this city. We're going to go deeply into this to try to figure out what the perspective is from the classroom. For 27 years, Don Wentroth was a school principal in this state. He's right now in the studio. Don, welcome.
Hello, John. Welcome to Oklahoma.
You've seen so much change in education in this state. You can't feel as though there's no commitment to education, but somehow the resources aren't there.
Well, I'd almost disagree. At least at the classroom level, it's very discouraging when there's not been any kind of or very little support. We hear a lot of lip service, but very little action to back that up.
So when you hear Leslie Osborne say, I'm starting to hear it, things are maybe going to change, you really need to see some actual action. You've heard that kind of message before.
Well, honestly, public schools in Oklahoma are really on life support right now. We are picking up change on the sidewalk, trying to survive and deliver a quality education to our kids, and they deserve better.
What's it like to hire a teacher in this state?
Difficult.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Because you can't expect pay raises, you can't expect benefits on a level of other states, even neighboring states.
Well, our students will, as they graduate from college, they can move across the border and instantly make $15,000 more a year, and that's significant to a young family or a young couple. And it is difficult, and it's, I'll just tell you, that's probably the most important part of my job as a school administrator is hiring quality people to be in front of kids every day. And the better the product in front of the kids, the less trouble there is in school. And it's becoming very difficult, very difficult.
What happened with sales tax, State Question 779? It was supposed to fund a teacher pay increase, but it was turned down.
It was. And I voted for that, but I'm not sure it was necessarily the right thing to do, because basically if that question would have passed, it would have taken the pressure off the legislature to do what they were elected to do, and that is to take care of the kids in this state, and they're not.
So they need to do something. It's more than just a sales tax like the mayor of Oklahoma City did to fund education here in this city.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. I think it has been misplaced. The legislature is looking at oil and gas and wind as the major resource in this state, and they have failed to recognize that the most important resource that we have are the young people that are going to continue the economy and continue to draw businesses here to the state. And without a really well or educated workforce, our state's in trouble. I don't care how low the taxes are. Nobody's coming to Oklahoma.
So I'm a parent. I'm walking into an AP class, and what do I see that tells me something's pretty wrong here?
Well, I sit next to a young man who's a senior in high school in our church choir, and I ask him at the first of this school year how his classes were. He's taken four advanced placement courses. He's taken a concurrent class at a university. He's in the band and also sings in his choir. And he said he really enjoyed his classes. His teachers were excellent. He's discouraged, though, because there's 40 students in each one of his advanced placement classes. And when I was asking him about that, his comment was, you can't get 40 desks in a room. They weren't built to have 40 desks in there. And so usually there's about eight of them that sit on the floor. They hope for people to be absent so that it frees up some extra seats for them to sit in. But in a calculus class, in an English lit class, how can you expect these kids, our very best, brightest kids, to really learn? And that's the bottom line, not just to be taught, but to really learn what's going on under those situations. It's critical.
Is this a situation where kids are the casualty of a sustained ideological approach to governing, where no taxes, and you go over the line, all of a sudden that's the situation you're in. Your kids are sitting on the floor.
Exactly. You know, educating kids is a pretty complicated job because they're all different. And just like managing and running a government, that's a complicated job. Well, we've enjoyed great success, I have, as a principal, because I trust the people that I work with, and we work together to solve these difficult problems. The group intelligence is always going to be higher than any single individual, and the people at our state capitol, I'm just going to limit it to that, they have got to get it together and cooperate and listen to all parties and try to avoid some of these pitfalls that they keep falling into.
All right. So Betsy DeVos is the cavalry. Charter schools, they're the cavalry here. That's going to change things. Vouchers is the cavalry here. What's your response?
Well, my response partly is I wish you hadn't have donated to my opponent's campaign that I was running against this fall.
So the nominee for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who's a very rich person in
right. Billionaire.
Yeah. She donated money to an opponent.
She donated $3,500 to my incumbent that I was running against. She donated $900 million to state officials across the nation that were running against educators. So
you don't think she's objective on this?
Well, she has no background. How can you understand? I will tell you, if she wanted to really get a good picture of what our kids and our schools needed, if our legislature really wanted to find out how to make our schools better, they're off every Friday. Every Friday they're off. They could certainly come and substitute for us. I could find them a place any day.
All right, Don Wentroth, let's give him a good round of applause there. We've been in the principal's office for the last few minutes. Don Wentroth, the school principal for 27 years in Oklahoma. Thanks so much, Don.
You're welcome.
On a big, broad street in Little Mexico, a neighborhood in Oklahoma City, past the stockyards and tucked into a row of pawn shops and a very popular Zumba studio, is the very festive Leo's Cakery.
How are the cannolis? Can I get one?
You can get as many as you want.
I think only one is good for me, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Cakes are for the good times, says Leo Guevara, who spent years in the grim Mexican city of Juarez, dreaming of having his own cake decorating business. Then for years he worked construction in Oklahoma so he could save up to buy every mixer, every refrigerator, every oven you see here in this shop. Today he's got a second location and a wildly decorated delivery truck. He voted for the first time in this election as a naturalized citizen, but he says the large community of Mexican immigrants in this once booming part of Oklahoma is not thinking about cake moments since the election. People are on edge, he says. They hear headlines like the Trump administration is serious about building a wall, and they worry they might have to move or be moved by a wave of Trump deportations.
It kind of hurts me because I'm not like that, you know. I'm not here in this country to do that. I'm here in this country to work and to do my part to make this community, this state, this country better. And I think I'm doing my part.
How does fear change the economy in a very predominantly immigrant neighborhood like this one?
It changed because there's some people that are really afraid of getting caught by police or immigration or anything like that. And they move, or they are thinking to move, and they rather just go elsewhere. And then if they go elsewhere, they take their money, and they take everything they do. And then for my particular business, if I have no people working, or like construction people or any type of job they do, if they are thinking to move out to another state or another country, that's people leaving and that's money leaving and that's everything leaving and I'll be less busy.
So fear of deportation means saving your money and not spending it, and that affects you?
Yes, that affects me big time. Because my type of product is not an essential product, okay? You don't have to have a birthday cake. You don't have to have a dessert. You do birthday cakes because you're happy, because you celebrate, because all of that, and that's what I live off. I live off people's parties, people's happy moments. So if there's no happy moments, I will be out of job.
How worried are you about your status or deportation of family members, that sort of thing?
I personally have family members that pretty much depend on the protection laws right now, and friends also. And if they cancel all that, if they close all of that, I mean, I'm afraid of I'll be with no friends, with no part of my family here, and that's not good.
So what do you fear most about this new administration and what Donald Trump is saying? Is it the wall? Is it the vetting? What is it?
I think it's a little bit of everything. For my Hispanic people will be the deportation, the wall, the cut of help, the cut of social help to people without the papers.
So reversing all of the Obama orders is going to have a really serious consequence to people here in this neighborhood.
Yes, yes, big time, big time. Because, like I said, I think maybe probably 50% will be affected. And that's a lot of people.
Do you feel powerless? Do the people in this neighborhood feel powerless?
I don't think we feel powerless because we can always keep doing our thing. But sometimes when you're in a country or area or place or state or city where you feel, or people make you feel, or the system make you feel powerless or unhappy, I mean, we always have the power to go elsewhere. And we like it here. You came to a country known by freedom, by the American dream, by a country where you can accomplish everything you want to do. But now, I think all that is changing. I don't think people feel like that. I don't think there's the American dream. It's going on a different way that no one's like it. And I feel like that. A year ago, I see myself, you know, with my business, a good job, you know, my car, my house, normal. And I thought I was living the American dream. But now, with all this, my question for myself is, do I want to be in this country? Do I want to be in this society? Probably not.
That's an emotional decision for you. That doesn't make you feel good.
No, it does not make me feel good, because if you hear, you're part of it. And you don't want to be part of society like that, at least not me.
When President Trump said, America first, from now on, America first, America first, what did you feel?
America first. I'll tell you one thing I have problem with all the time. First of all, I don't like when people say America, because the United States is not America. The United States, it's called the United States of America. So when people say America, first of all, I don't like it. To me, it's the United States. So America first, I think it's a lie too, because like I said before, everybody, every person, every human being that is here in this country, in the United States, that he meant America, everybody is America first. So if he's going to send a bunch of people out and build some tall walls and cut commerce with other countries, I don't know. I don't see how it's America first.
You feel like there's a contempt for Hispanics right now coming from Washington.
I do. I guess it's really hard to say right now, but I don't think I'll be very happy seeing the government doing this to people, separating families, and to me, it's all doing the wrong thing.
Leo Guevara is the owner of Leo's Cakery with two convenient locations in Oklahoma City. We want to say thank you to all the people at KOSU for having us. So let's hear from some of them. Especially thanks to Rachel Hubbard. She did an amazing job, our tour guide. She booked many of the interviews we did while we were here. It's also her birthday today. Let's hear it again. Other folks, Kelly Burley, Ken Boyd, Dustin Drew, and Jenny Heinrichs, as well as all the Oklahomans who opened their homes to us and talked so candidly about their feelings about America. Thanks to so much to you for listening to us out here in the Heartland. I'm John Huckabee. This is The Takeaway.